Mr. Watson, Reel 6. Whilst you were in India in those pre-independence days, what did you and the other teachers generally think about Indian political parties, like the Congress agitation that was going on at the time?
Yes, well, we were not affected at all, fortunately. Again, as I say, because Dehradun was a quiet spot, and militarily, we just took no part. I have a feeling that both Gandhi and Nehru were a bit of a thorn in the flesh of the Britisher at the time. Gandhi's ideas, of course, were in theory absolutely splendid. I mean, his theory of non-violence, but of course it wasn't always carried out. Apart from that, I think the communist was very much like the communist in England. He was the troublemaker, and the Congress Party corresponded very largely to the conservatives, or possibly the liberals in England, and they seemed to me quite a good type of political party, as far as I could make out. But of course, as I say, I'm not a political animal, and I wouldn't like to judge any further than that.
Were you as a teacher in those pre-independence days conscious very much of the existence of a communist party in India?
Only by hearsay and what we read in the newspapers. There were very often riots down in the south of India, in what is now Kerala, and in and around Bombay, particularly in the mills, because they very often seemed to be having trouble there. And I think they were communist agitated. But personally, we had no direct contact, or we weren't affected at all.
What did you think of the Muslim League and Jinnah?
Well, Jinnah, I think, was... I don't quite know what to say. I think he made a great mistake, and he was not a good type for Pakistan anyway, although he originated it. They were martial in their outlook. They were very looking out for trouble, as far as I could make out. And then, of course, you had this the Mufti up in Kashmir. He was another sore thorn in the flesh. But apart from that, I'm afraid I don't know a great deal about it. I wasn't terribly interested, and certainly not affected.
You're in India at the time of the Second World War, when a number of Indian troops were recruited by the Japanese to the Indian National Army of Subhash Chandra Bose.
Mm. Yeah.
Did that affect your cadets and the college in any way?
It didn't affect the college at all, nor did it affect the academy. But it did affect some of the people who were officers in the army. In fact, two of our ex-cadets, both of high rank, one was a lieutenant colonel, the other was a brigadier, and he became a general, joined the INA. They fought throughout the war against the British. They were both good chaps. One of them had been to Sandhurst, the elder of the two. The other one was one of the first cadets at the Indian Military Academy, and incidentally he was the brother of the first VC of the war, Indian VC of the war, an elder brother who was also an ex-cadet. After the war finished, the elder one retired as a general, and the younger one was reinstated in the Indian Army. I know them both. I know them now. when I say I know them now, I knew them when I left. Actually, the general has died now, and I used to stay with him whenever I went down to Delhi, and he's a very good chap indeed, and he used to give me his point of view, and he felt that his attitude was that India had to stand on its own legs, and the only way it could do it was to find its own salvation. That was his feeling in the matter, and that was why he joined.
Was there any difference between the attitudes of the staff and the cadets at the college, or academy for that matter, in the days immediately after independence, when the ruling Congress party were treating the INA men as almost as kind of heroes?
No, it didn't affect us at all. Not in any way. I mean, all this was just what we heard by hearsay and what we read in the papers. And life just went on absolutely as normal at both the college and the academy.
What did you feel about it yourself? The Congress's attitude towards the INA?
Well, I think it was all wrong, frankly. I think that they certainly should not have treated them as heroes. One can appreciate their point of view, but after all, from the officer point of view, they had taken an oath to serve the Indian Army, and the Indian Army was fighting against Japan and, of course, Germany. And therefore, they were breaking their oath from that point of view. So that from that standpoint, it was wrong that they should have joined.
You must have... Your college must have attracted the attention of quite a few leading personalities. Did you ever get visits from important people?
Well, of course, being under the Defense Department completely, we had absolutely everybody of any importance whatsoever would come to the college. I mean, from the Viceroy downwards. The Viceroy, we had several Viceroys. I forget them all now. Anyway, each one came in his turn. The Commander-in-Chief, CGS, after partition, Nehru. In fact, we even had an Admiral of the Fleet came up all the way from Bombay once. Nehru came, the Defence Minister, the President of India, they all automatically came to the college at some time in their career, so that we were always doing our stuff. And of course, we always had the big shots in the army, like Lord Gort, General Auchinleck, General Wavell, Mountbatten, they all came. I remember Mountbatten giving us a lecture once when he came up.
Were there any of these personalities who made a particular impression on you?
Yes, in different forms. I think Mountbatten, for his friendliness and his ability. Wavell was very quiet and reserved. That was at a time after he'd come away from Egypt. He came back to India. Nehru, of course, was an idealist, I think. The Indian president, he was pleasant. He was rather more of a figurehead than anything else. And I think he always will be. I mean, that is the idea of having an Indian president, I think. Who else did I say? Mountbatten?
Auchinleck?
Auchinleck was a splendid man. So was Lord Gort. Very downright, both of them. Very much to the point, very much on the ball in both cases. And very impressive. And I'm glad to say they were all very much impressed by the standards in the college too, which was very heartening.
Didn't you tell me that you once had a rather amusing, almost clash with Nehru once at an airport?
Yeah, well, it wasn't a clash with Nehru so much as he was going off. I was staying with General Bonsley. He was the fellow who was in the INA, the National Army. I was staying with him in Delhi. I'd had to go down to Delhi in connection with college business, and I was staying with Bonsley. And it so happened that Nehru had to go to this Southeast Asian conference when all the big shots like Nasser and Chuen Lai and one or two others were all meeting. And all the diplomats and all the senior army officers had to go, it was a sort of ritual, to see Nehru off in the early morning, see him off in his plane. And we arrived there quite early, I suppose about 7 o'clock, 7:30. Nehru came along, and all the diplomats and everybody were lined up. And Nehru came along and shook hands with everyone. And he was introduced by a major. And after that, it was Chuen Lai and then Nasser. And before that happened, while they were waiting for, I think it was Nasser to come, I'm not quite sure, the plane was standing quite near, and people were sort of strolling about, and there was one soldier, a private, standing near it with a rifle, not taking much notice of anything or anybody, and I wanted to have a look at the plane. I was rather interested in the undercarriage and the retractable wheels. And I went right up to the plane and was examining this hydraulic system. And then I came back and I lined up with all the diplomats and what have you and shook hands with these various people as they came through. And then after Nehru and his party had gone off, we went back to General Bonsley's bungalow, and I told him the whole story. I said, I think that was pretty poor. I could have done absolutely anything to that plane if I'd wanted to. I mean, it would have been the simplest thing in the world to shove a stick of dynamite or what have you, or a bomb in that undercarriage, and that would have been the end of the lot of them. Well, he was rather amazed at that, and he said, well, I must tell Nehru about that. And he did tell Nehru, and Nehru absolutely blew his top. He really went for those guards completely, and he really was upset, and quite rightly, too, because, as I say, supposing I had been any stranger or anybody that wanted to do any damage, there would have been no Nehru, no Chuen Lai, no Nasser, no nobody. And that was that.
I think you have had another story you told me about you discovering a German spy was discovered during the war
in
India. Yes,
that was rather interesting. Some of us decided that it would be a very good thing to bring radio to the local villages all around Dehradun within a radius of about 20 miles. And we got a radio mechanic, very clever man indeed, to design a set which would be suitable to pick up all India radio, which he did. And we had this prototype set, and so about five of us went out to the various villages to test. We rigged up an aerial and connected up to this radio set to see what sort of reception was being had and if it would be suitable for the riots, which was a sort of collection of country village people. They get together and sit under a tree and conduct their business or what have you, and we thought that they'd be able to listen to the radio. Well, we went round to various villages, and the one of the leading lights, who was forest research man, knew several people in high places, Rajas and millionaire Indians, and managed to collect quite a lot of money. And so we got the whole scheme sorted out and started. One of the men, this radio mechanic fellow who owned a shop by the name of Sweet, as I say, he was very clever. And the next thing we heard after the whole scheme had got underway was that Sweet had been arrested in Missouri. He was a German spy. He'd been broadcasting to Germany, giving the movements of Indian troops, obviously. And that was the last we heard of him or saw of him. I heard no more. What happened to him, I have no idea to this day.
Had you come into personal contact with him?
Oh, yes, rather. I knew him well. He had a shop in Dehradun and a shop in Missouri. And we used to deal with him. And as I say, he was a very, very clever radio mechanic. And so we roped him in when we had this idea of trying to introduce radio to the local villagers. That was the main object, because he was the man who would produce the sets and who could design something that would be suitable.
And you'd never suspected that there's anything wrong with him
at all? Nothing. Had no idea.
I think you said that batteries in India were extremely expensive and difficult to get hold of.
Yes. In fact, I remember one fellow actually bringing one all the way out from England in his handbag and smuggling it through customs at Bombay.
Was this a car battery?
A car battery, yes. Oh, yes. I'm talking of car batteries. There were stories of trucks which had been assembled in India, which were being sent out to North Africa, and when they arrived, they were exported from Bombay, and when they arrived in North Africa by boat, of course, they found that all the batteries were dead, which was very serious indeed in that campaign. And presumably what had happened was that someone had conveniently removed them in Bombay and substituted dud batteries and presumably flogged the good ones on the black market. But that's somewhat hearsay.
I think you said that corruption was often suspected in the case of subcontractors as well.
I think that was more or less universal. Contractors and subcontractors, they always did themselves well. They seemed to be driving around in large, luxurious cars, which their normal pay would presumably not be able to provide for them. And then there was the case of the, I think it's the Nangal Dam, where the thing burst its banks after it had been finished and was completely useless because the type of cement that had been put in was most unsuitable, presumably too much sand, I don't know. That again could only have been done by the contractors and not proper supervision.
Do you think that any of the Britishers were ever guilty of corruption in India?
I think it's quite possible. You would have British contractors. Oh, yes. I think it's possible. You had that in the, what did they call it? PWD.
Public Works Department.
Public Works Department, yes. They had British contractors there. It's possible, I don't know. I mean, I'm not in a position to judge. But I think there was so much corruption throughout India, not merely in that line, but even at lower levels. It was tragic in so many ways, and of course that led to black marketeering too, very much during the war.
In what type of goods?
The main goods, grain chiefly. The main goods that were required by the Indian. Rice, grain, sugar. They were all put away, stacked away, and brought out when prices would be sufficiently high or sold on the black market.
Were you ever asked for bribes or dastur or anything of that kind whilst you were in India?
No. Not directly, no. Never. I remember the college head Dobie tried to not exactly bribe me, but influence me in the decision. We always had, every year, we had to call in for tenders for the laundry and for the catering. Now, the Dobie, of course, he'd been there for years, and he thought, well, I'm on a good wicket here, and I'll just mention it to the Barasab, and he'll pass mine through. But I had to explain to him no uncertain terms that I didn't make the choice, that all the tenders were sent to the Defence Department at Army Headquarters in Delhi, and the choice was theirs, not mine.
So he didn't offer you money, he just tried to appeal to your long-standing friendship.
Yes. Yes. There's one interesting story which happened before partition. Hazir Sahib, who was our contractor, had his own dairy and, of course, his own cows. And one morning he came down and he said, Sahib, a cow of mine's been taken by a tiger. Now, this seemed very strange because the college was in its own cantonment, as it were, its own department. And next to the college was a very large tea garden. And being cantonments, we didn't expect tigers in our part of the world. Perhaps they might have come later on in the season. Anyway, we didn't quite know what to do, so we sent for a Gurkha who we knew was a very good tracker from the second Gurkhas. And he came over and he showed us exactly what had happened. We could see the whole thing taking place by his description. He pointed out where it had pounced on the cow, dragged her along. He would show us by displacement of grass. Now, at the top of the college grounds, there was a wall, outside of which was a road. The wall was about 3 feet high, not more. And the tiger had dragged the cow up to the wall, over the wall, and he showed us where there was displacement of the stonework and bits of fur, along the road, which was only a path, and then over the wall on the other side, into the tea garden, and away off through the tea garden. And it was most illuminating to listen to the way he described it. Of course, we never found it. We never saw the tiger. It just completely disappeared, complete with cow. And that was that. Fortunately, we never had any recurrence. But it was quite frightening.
You never came across any man-eaters?
No.